Welcome back. My guest is Jim Rickards. He's the founder of the James Rickards Project and author of many books. His latest is Money GPT, AI, and the Threat to the Global Economy. His website, jamesrickardsproject.com. He's on X at Real Jim Rickards. Jim, welcome to This Week in Money.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Can you tell us first about your Money GPT book and where our listeners can buy it?
Sure. It came out late last year, just about a year old this month, as a matter of fact. It's called Money GPT, AI and the Threat to the Global Economy. It's obviously about AI. GPT is a generative pre-trained transformers. That's a geeky term, but it talks about a new technology that has been used to empower AI to produce, essays and reports and graphics that are extremely well done, to the point that college students don't work anymore. They just go to GPT and get their essays written by the computer. There's a little less there than meets the eye, but that was where the name GPT comes from. But what I do, I'm not bashing AI. AI is powerful. It's everywhere. It's on your dashboard of your car. It's in your refrigerator. My refrigerator tells me to change the water filter. Well, I ignore it, but that's AI, because it has a clock and a humidifier and does all that computation, tells me what to do. And it will have very powerful effects. There'll be some diseases that get cured because of AI. But I was doing a different take on it. I wasn't saying it's here, it's real, it's powerful, so I'll stipulate all that. But there are a lot of hidden dangers. A lot of things are being ignored. And it's not really about the stock bubble. We are in a bubble. We all know what's going on with NVIDIA and Microsoft, and OpenAI is a private company, but it's got like a $500 billion valuation. They haven't even made any money. So we see the impact of AI on the stock market. It's very clear that that's a bubble, but who knows when it'll break. When it'll break, it'll break pretty hard, but I'll leave that to others. What I did is looked at how AI is used in the stock market for trading, portfolio allocations, et cetera, could amplify and accelerate a stock market crash. Crashes have been around forever. Go back to the mid-14th century, 1350, give or take a year, the House of Bardi and the House of Peruzzi in Italy collapsed, caused a European-wide financial panic just a couple years before the Black Death. So there's nothing new about that. A lot of that's just human nature. But when you harness AI to the trading system, the decision-making system, outsource your decisions to the AI, you may find that, first of all, the crash happens a lot faster than you think. Secondly, no one can find the kill switch because it's not humans anymore. It's computers making the decision, and they'll just operate faster and on a more deterministic basis. In a normal market, you've got humans, and there'll be bulls and bears and longs and shorts and people taking different views, and that, it doesn't mean panics don't happen. They do, but they're kind of equilibrious. But with computers, they're all programmed the same way, particularly AI, because AI uses what's called a training set, which is, materials, basically the whole internet. They have these large language models. They turn the AI programs, algorithms loose on the entire internet. The models compute logical sequences, words that go together. That's how they produce grammatical essays, et cetera. But when it comes to finance, they're all going to do the same thing, which is what happens when the stock market starts to melt down? What's a good strategy for you individually? Well, a good strategy is sell your stocks, go to cash, move to the sidelines, wait till it's over, and then tiptoe back in at better valuations. That's a really good individual strategy. But it falls prey to something called the logic of a paradox of composition, which means that something that makes sense for an individual is disastrous at scale. So I'll give you a simple example. You're at a baseball game, if you're in Canada, a football game, et cetera, and the person in front of you is particularly tall or wearing a funny hat. You can't see the game very well. So what's the solution? Well, you can stand up, and right away you get a better view. It's like, hey, that works. But then the person behind you stands up, and the person behind her stands up. Next thing you know, the whole stadium's on their feet. Nobody has a better view because relatively you're all the same, but everybody's worse off because you're all standing. That's the technical name for this, the fallacy of composition. But the point being, selling your stocks, going to cash and waiting out the crash is good for an individual. But what happens when everybody does that? Well, the market goes no bid. Everybody's a seller. Nobody's a buyer. The market goes straight down. You blow through the firewalls and you literally close the markets. And it's problematic as to whether you can reopen them again. That, is what will happen with AI, because if all the AI is programmed the same, there are no humans around to say, oh, you know, maybe it's a good time to buy. Maybe I should buy the dip. Maybe I should step in. No, the computers are all going to do the thing that makes sense for an individual, but in the aggregate, it'll crash the markets. There's a lot more to it than that. I have a chapter on nuclear war fighting. I have a chapter on superintelligence, chapters on bias and censorship. There's a lot there, but I hope readers enjoy it. You can find it on Amazon. It's in bookstores, but Amazon is probably the best way to get it, and they give you a nice discount.
Do you think AI could be the cause of global economic problems or the scapegoat for it?
Both. It will cause global economic problems along the lines I just described. You know, I talked about the stock market, my example, but the same thing could be true in the banking system. You know, run on the bank. Again, nothing new about runs on the bank. But now, instead of, you know, we've all seen grainy black and white pictures in the 1930s of guys in, you know, overcoats and fedoras hunkered down in the rain, lined up around the block, trying to get the money out of the bank. And of course, it's too late because the insiders already took all the money and the doors are closed. But that kind of thing can happen now much faster. So, if I get word that a certain bank is in trouble, this did happen with Silicon Valley Bank, by the way, it was 2023, but it wasn't that long ago. I can take my smartphone, my, you know, iPhone or Samsung or whatever, and move the money, hold the phone in my hand, just with a finger, move the money, and then text my best friend and say, hey, get your money out. I just moved mine. That can all happen. You know, you don't need to line up around the block anymore. It can all happen very, very quickly and at scale. These could be million-dollar transfers I'm talking about or more. So the point being, it'll exacerbate banking crises, and then I talk about other behavioral aspects of it. So it can definitely be what in the military we call force multiplier. Again, human nature is the catalyst, but AI is a force multiplier that makes it happen even faster. Now, your second point was a really good one, which is it going to get blamed for things? So right now, we've seen some big layoff announcements from Amazon and Target. IBM did also, but Amazon and Target in particular, because they're oriented to the retail market. It's the Christmas season. They usually hire people during the Christmas season. Why are they laying people off? Well, first of all, that's a very bad economic sign, independent of AI. That's not good if you're firing people in the month before Christmas. But everyone's blaming AI. It's like, oh, you know, Amazon and Target, they've got all these robots and they've got this AI and they don't need the workers anymore. That's nonsense. I mean, they are using AI and they are using more robots, and there will be labor market repercussions from that. But that's all going to take time. But in the short run right now, what they're doing is they're blaming AI, but when in fact the economy's slowing down, and that's why they're laying people off. So I do think that AI, apart from everything else we just discussed, has become a very convenient scapegoat for things that are actually normal economic cyclical downturns.
Is artificial intelligence just next level programming?
No, it is different. I mean, you can say next level programming is all computer algorithms and code involved, you know, engineering and developers and coding and programming. So that's common to, you know, the computer in general. But it's not just next level. It really is different. And the GPT phenomenon I mentioned, again, generative pre-trained transformer, what that does, it takes computing that used to be done sequentially, like solve this problem, solve the next problem, solve the next problem, output becomes input, et cetera. And it breaks it up into pieces and allows it to be done in parallel. Now, the pieces converge to a solution at the end, but if you can process in parallel instead of sequentially, you can do more faster. That's why the chip side of it's so important, because you do need these super fast, you know, particularly NVIDIA, but AMD and a few others make them, but these super fast NVIDIA chips to be able to utilize GPT. And then the other element is the internet, because the training sets are bigger. I mean, it's one thing to scan in the pages of, you know, Charles Dickens or Shakespeare or something, but when you've got basically all the knowledge in the history of the world digitized in the internet somewhere, It's out there somewhere. So you've got a bigger pool of information. You've got faster processing. And you've got large language models and the GPT technology that enables you to not just process faster in terms of the chips, but also in terms of the logical sequences. So it is different, and it's powerful. That doesn't mean it's flawless. In fact, there are tons of flaws, but it is different.
There's a push to control, censor, and surveil the people of the world. Is AI being used to make this happen, and could different AI be used to put a stop to it?
Yes, and maybe. So the first one, yeah, this is what Palantir does. I remember around 2001, 2002, Admiral John Poindexter proposed a system called Total Information Awareness, TIA. It means ant in Spanish, but anyway. He said, let's get all the data we can, all the computer power we can, keep tabs on everybody, profile terrorists. You know, so it was after 9/11. There was a reason for it, but his program was Total Information Awareness. And it got rejected very quickly. Everyone's like, oh, we don't want that. You'll put the good guys under surveillance. How are you going to profile and all that? So it was kind of rejected, at least superficially. But here we are. I mean, I'm not dinging Palantir as a great company, but what Palantir does is total information awareness. Now, this plays into central bank digital currencies, Chinese social credit scores. This is going on all over the world. Britain has, Prime Minister Starmer has proposed a digital ID card for all members, all subjects in the UK. Now, they always do this. They always sell it on the basis of convenience and security. Now, this will, central bank digital currencies will make your transactions faster and cheaper, more reliable. A digital ID card will open the door to, sporting venues or voting or whatever you want to use. And it's always sold on the basis of convenience and speed and cost. And some of those claims are valid. These things can be better, faster, cheaper. But what they don't tell you is that they're gathering all the information. They can process it just along the lines I described earlier, talking about what GPT is, and keep tabs on everybody. And they, then they use it for marketing reasons. I'd like to go to Trinidad on vacation. And then you go to your internet browser and there's five ads for Trinidad vacation. It's like, gee, how did the computer know I was, thinking about taking a vacation in Trinidad? Well, it's because it was listening to you. Your iPhone is listening to you. You're being wiretapped, filmed, surveyed, monitored, position located all the time, whether you know it or not. Now, does that information allow advertisers and marketers to target the audience and, don't send me, a certain kind of commercial, because I don't drink a lot of beer, so don't hit me with a beer commercial, but hit me with something else. Yeah, they do use it for that, but it's also used for, as we've seen with the weaponization of the FBI and abuse of power by the Biden administration, they targeted basically half the Republicans in the Senate under this Operation Arctic Frost, and they came up with phony charges against Donald Trump to the point of impeachment with Operation Crossfire Hurricane. So the kind of technology we're talking about, combined with abuse of power, absolutely makes everyone a target and enables not just government surveillance, but profiling and actually start to disadvantage you, put you on a watch list. Or in China, I mean, if you say anything against the party, you'll quickly find that you can't buy a plane ticket, you can't buy a train ticket, your kids will not get into college, et cetera, that you will be socially crushed because you had remarks or wrote a paper or gave a speech or whatever that was not in line with the Communist Party ideology. And then it can get worse than that. They can arrest you and take your organs out without anesthetic because you're a political enemy, and then you die. So yes, that is going on. It is enabled by AI. And the powerful chips. Palantir is a leader in around the world, but it's a U.S.-based company, but there are others doing it as well. Now, the second part of your question is, can we use AI to fight back? I think that capacity is limited. You could have, in theory, a cyber war, but do everyday people have access to that kind of technology? Do they know how to use it? Do they know how to fight back? Some do, but most don't. But there is a lot you can do. You can use Faraday bags. A Faraday bag is a, let's say it can be a pouch or a briefcase or, you know, just a sack or whatever, but it's lined with certain metallic fibers that cut radio transmission. So if your phone is, if they're tracking you with your phone, turning your phone off is not good enough. But turn your phone off, put it in a Faraday bag, and now it goes dark. The government can't track that. Use cash instead of credit cards. I worked with programs with the CIA where the questions, could you track a terrorist using their credit card purchases, assuming they don't have a cell phone and they're smart enough not to do that, could you track that with credit card? The answer is yes. It's a lot to it, but you can do that. So use cash, put your cell phone in a Faraday sack, take down your EasyPass transponders, stay off highways with toll booths, you know, take local roads, use a bicycle. There's just a whole bunch of things that individuals can do to go off grid, either completely if you have a farm somewhere, or in certain dimensions with your cell phone, your car. You know, drive an old car, get a 15-year-old car because it doesn't have all this electronics in it. A modern car, you know, again, I said put your cell phone in a Faraday sack. Yeah, but your car is one big, you know, transmitter. They're tracking your car. And they're using, you know, the toll booths are monitoring stations. They read your license plates. There are, you can take your front license plate off depending on the state. Back license plate, there are these plastic shields that, you know, in theory, someone close up can read the license plate, but the cameras can. It kind of blurs it for the camera. So there are a large number of strategies that individuals can adopt to minimize tracking and minimize your footprint on the grid. The internet grid, if you will, the surveillance grid, that are helpful. Don't fool yourself and think you're 100% off the grid, but getting 90% off the grid is pretty good. They're going to probably go look at somebody else.
I think you've answered this question. Are there ways to drastically reduce or eliminate control, censorship, and surveillance?
Surveillance in particular, control and censorship, you know, it depends. That's actually more difficult because, let me step back. Meta, which, you know, basically Facebook and Google have used completely fascist censorship techniques because they control so many channels. Those two companies together control, you know, we say, okay, Facebook is what it is and Google search engine, but they own collectively, they own the YouTube, Instagram, WhatsApp. They own a lot of, different channels that people rely on, whether people may not realize that they're all owned by Meta and Google, which is one thing, by the way, the government could do is use the antitrust laws to break them up, but I'm not holding my breath for that. But so they can deplatform you. I've seen examples of that. I did an interview with a good friend of mine who had a YouTube channel in Australia, and she used it for marketing purposes. I was happy to do an interview. It was content for her. But I said things like, this is back during the COVID days. I said, well, you know, the vaccines are a joke. They're killing more people than they're not saving anyone. They're killing people and the masks don't work. And 6-foot social distancing the guy who came up with it was a late 19th century German scientist who later admitted he didn't know what he was talking about. At the entire lockdown, D.A. Henderson, greatest immunologist, the man given credit for eradicating smallpox on the planet Earth. He wrote a paper in 2006, said lockdowns don't work. He explained why. So everything we were told during the pandemic was a lie. Social distancing doesn't work with an airborne respiratory virus. Masks don't work because the virus is smaller than the weave of the mask. Lockdowns don't work. They destroy the economy very effectively, but they don't work to stop the disease. The virus goes where it wants to go. And the vaccines are not really vaccines, they're experimental gene modification therapies. So, I said, and it's all true, by the way, there's documentary evidence. I wrote a book on that, by the way, it's the best selling book on COVID called The New Great Depression. It came out, in 2021. So all this was clear, you know, 5-6 years ago. I mean, you hear more about it today, but it was clear at the time. But my point is, my friend's YouTube channel was taken down. Because of what I said, I had to go and say, you know, sorry, but, and she got reinstated. But yeah, that kind of censorship was, and there were many worse examples. That was one I happened to be personally acquainted with. So, they're fascist, censors. They do what the government tells them. That's the bad news. The good news is there are, almost no barriers to entry to start your own podcast. And there are channels like Getter, Rumble, Twitter used to be fascist censorship, but with Elon Musk, it's a lot more free. So, Breitbart News and others. So there are a lot of channels out there where you can get good information, but you know, if you're on them, if you're a guest or an interview subject or a host or whatever, or even start your own podcast, it's not hard to do, but don't rely on YouTube and, Instagram and, to get your message out because they're heavily censored.
What are the countries with the most freedom and are they likely to remain that way?
Well, I like Antarctica. I was there recently and there's no government at all. So I thought that was good. There's a treaty where countries agree to do or not do certain things, but that's, like you say, it's a treaty. It's an agreement among countries, but there's no government at all. The closest thing to a government is the cruise vessel operators. They try to space out the cruise ship schedules, not have more than one in a certain harbor, certain inlet, not really harbors because there's no structures down there, but certain inlet at a certain time. But I like Antarctica. That's my model because there's no government at all. Beyond that, sometimes you find, I would say the United States is getting less free. I would say the UK is kind of looking like the old, East Germany during the Cold War. I mean, the censorship, you get arrested for saying the wrong thing. The UK is very, very close to fascism. France and Germany are a little better. For freedom, it's hard to know. There are places, I just got back from Slovenia, very beautiful country, small population, 2 million people, fairly homogeneous, very peaceful, very prosperous. I met with some government officials. My advice to them was quit NATO, quit the EU, get out of the ECB, bag the euro, start your own currency, and put half your reserves in gold. People came up to me after the presentation. That's the kind of thing that would get you arrested in the UK these days, but people came up to me after the presentation. They said, thank you for saying what you said. We agree. Our government doesn't agree, but that a lot of us are thinking the same way. So a lot of countries that are maybe not as well known off the run, and Slovenia, like I say, it's a very, very small country, but I found that it was a breath of fresh air. I really liked the people, and I thought the government was doing a lot of things right. And then sometimes there are places where they might even have a socialist government, but socialists are so bad at what they do. In a perverse way, you kind of get freedom because they want to control you, but they're bad at it, so you end up not having much control. I mean, that's paradoxical, but that kind of exists. Pick your spots. But I would put, I was in Bosnia. Again, people are very nice. I really enjoyed my time there. I think Europe is moving pretty quickly towards fascism. Portugal might be okay, but France, Germany, UK, Poland, partly because of the war in Ukraine, but they're all moving towards fascism. The U.S., we were very far down that road with Biden, Biden and Zuckerberg and Google, censoring the kinds of things we talked about already. Trump has stopped some of that, but it takes a while to erase it. You can't clean up the deep state in 6 months, although they're trying. So things are probably getting a little better in the U.S. Canada is very fascist. Australia, I mean, what they did in Victoria during COVID, they had concentration camps. I mean, they weren't death camps. I guess some people died, but they weren't death camps, but they were concentration camps where they rounded people up and put them in these, COVID concentrations where you were not allowed out in the general population. It doesn't do any good. It doesn't stop the virus, but it is purely fascist, borderline totalitarian. I would say freedom is very much on the decline, very much in jeopardy in places that are supposedly free, like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, Ireland's getting that way, and the United States is much better. But there are countries that have a Cold War legacy, but have actually broken out, and where I think freedom is, you can feel it, and I would put Slovenia and Bosnia in that category.
The World Economic Forum slogan is, you'll own nothing and be happy. Most wealth is in real estate and financial instruments. How could people go from owning all this wealth to owning nothing?
Well, you know, Karl Marx wrote thousands of pages and made lots of research. A lot of people, I'm going to say most people, at least with a college education, read the Communist Manifesto, which is, you know, it's a pamphlet. I mean, it's about 100 pages. It's easy to get through. But, you know, if Capital, good luck, that's two volumes, over 1,000 pages, much more dense, and other writings as well. But someone asked Marx, he said, you know, you've written thousands and thousands of pages on communism. He said, can you boil it down to one sentence? Like, and he said, well, if I had to boil it down to one, you know, sentence or phrase, communism is the abolition of private property. The abolition of private property. Now, think about the World Economic Forum. You will own nothing. What does that mean? Well, that is the abolition of private property because you don't own anything. So it's communist. I don't think we need to belabor it. That's just who they are.
Going forward, where do you think the safest places will be to store wealth?
Well, it depends on what kind of wealth. I mean, if it's real estate, then it is wherever it is. You might want to pick your spots or pick your jurisdictions. I wouldn't count on owning real estate in China or a lot of other places. But, you know, at least the rule of law in the U.S. is still pretty good. And it tends to vary state by state, although they can tax you out of existence. So I'd watch out for property taxes. But, you know, real estate, by definition, is wherever it is. Same thing with physical gold. Now, you do have storage issues. The worst place to put gold is in a bank safe deposit box, because that's the first place they'll look. If they want to come and get it, they'll just open all the safe deposit boxes and take all the gold. So you want either private storage, and if you say, I want to go overseas with that, you have a different issue. I know a lot of Russians and others store gold in Dubai. I know where the gold vaults are there. A lot of people like Singapore, they store their gold there, Switzerland, of course. The problem with all of those is they can be relatively safe jurisdictions, but how are you going to get there? Like, when you want the gold, how are you going to get there? So if the world's falling apart, you know, are you going to be able to fuel your private jet? Is the pilot going to want to fly you there if he has to leave his family behind? I mean, people who think they're good at, you know, catastrophe planning actually don't think a lot of things through to, like I say, the practicalities of how you get your gold in that scenario. One thing I have noticed, by the way, I've been to a lot of gold vaults around the world. They're all next to airports. They're all really close to airports, small airports in some cases, where you can, you know, in theory, fly your private plane in and get your gold and fly out all pretty quickly. So keep it out of the banks. There are some reputable private storage companies, Brinks, Loomis, a few others. I'm not, you know, endorsing anybody, but I happen to know they're pretty good companies. The best security is just, you know, put it in a safe place and don't tell anyone you have it.
Are small banks starting to collapse, and should we be concerned?
No, small banks are fine. I actually keep a lot of money in a small bank that was started in 1877. I was like, okay, you survived the panic of 1893, 1898, 1907, 1929, the Great Depression, and a lot else in 2008, so you must be doing something right. So I think small banks, if you're careful, are fine. The big banks are too big to fail. Now, there are different ways to lose money in banks. Most people, you're worried about losing your deposits. And I think the too big to fail banks will prop that up. Deposit insurance is $250,000, but that's per individual, per account. So a husband and wife, for example, could have two accounts. An IRA would be a third account that's separate. There's more than one bank. So you know, husband and wife together could open two accounts each at three different banks. And now you've got six accounts. Now you're up to, what, $1.5 million or so. And so you can actually get a lot of money insured by FDIC by using multiple banks and multiple accounts. But, you know, assuming you have more than that, and some individuals do, a lot of businesses do, The small banks are probably the best. The big banks are too big to fail. The danger is the mid-sized banks. And mid-sized, I would define as between 100 billion and 900 billion in deposits. So you're not in the kind of multi-trillion-dollar category, but you're not a small bank either. But you're not big enough to be too big to fail, but you are big enough to fail, meaning you don't have the financial controls, et cetera, and risk management, and you are vulnerable to a run on the bank. You don't have the confidence of your investors, et cetera. So I would look for banks in that kind of 100 billion to 900 billion total asset range. And one of the indicators I look at is, and it's very easy to compute, this is all this information is publicly available, compute the ratio of insured deposits to total deposits. And the higher the ratio, the safer the bank. But take Silicon Valley Bank, for example. The ratio is 3%. Only 3% of the deposits in Silicon Valley Bank were insured. 97% were uninsured because they were over the FDIC insurance limit. That bank could fail in a heartbeat because people who are not insured are going to get their money out fast, and they did. And then the government had to come in, and they ended up insuring everybody whether they were within the limits or not. They basically blew off the FDIC insurance limit and guaranteed everybody because they had no other way to stop the crisis. But if you want to know whether a bank is going to have to suffer a run on the bank in the first place, look at the ratio of insured to total. If it's 60 or 70%, that's a pretty safe bank. If it's 10%, it's a very risky bank.
Could artificial intelligence be programmed to keep you from your wealth?
Sure. You don't need artificial intelligence. You just need a phone call and freeze the assets. This is the problem with digital wealth. You can freeze it with a phone call. Or a few keystrokes. So the wealth that's harder to steal is physical gold. If it's, not in the banks, land, obviously silver, I would say the same thing. Fine art, cash, meaning cash, like bills, not in the bank, but any kind of digital wealth, with or without artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence would be used to profile you and track you, and then, a phone call or keystrokes are enough to freeze the assets.
On one hand, technology is our friend. On the other hand, our foe. What are your thoughts on the good and the bad of technology, and especially AI?
Well, there's something called the law of conservation of information in search. Not very well known, but the author of a paper on that topic, peer-reviewed, is a collaborator of mine. We work together on other projects. And he has a very rigorous mathematical proof of the proposition. And what it says is that it doesn't matter how fast your chips are, it doesn't matter how good your artificial intelligence is, you will never find anything new. Can AI search faster? Yes. Can it search more broadly? Yes. But whatever it comes back with is already there. It cannot come up with any new information. So where does new information come from? Well, it comes from humans through creativity. Musicians, artists, writers, mathematicians. It doesn't have to be art. It can be science. But my point being, humans create new information. Computers don't. They can find it faster, but they can't create it. That's one of the limitations in AI that people don't appreciate. It will, as I say, search gets faster and broader, and it will come up with things that humans couldn't come up with in any reasonable period of time. But it doesn't mean it's not already there. It's not really creative.
Are Bitcoin and other cryptos products of AI?
No, they're actually pretty crude. The blockchain has been around since the late 70s, early 80s. The mathematical formula for Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining was original, but it's very limited. People say, I have an anonymity on the blockchain. Well, not really, because the blockchain, anyone looking at the blockchain can tell whether a set of transactions were by the same party or not. You may not know the name of that party, So you have that kind of anonymity, but based on the code, you can see that it was the same party, for example, in one or more transactions. And based on that, we know that over 90% of all the Bitcoin transactions are conducted by fewer than 5% of the Bitcoin holders. In other words, there's a small group of so-called whales with enormous amounts of Bitcoin who are conducting the vast majority of the transactions. And everyone else is kind of a sucker, you know, being brought along in the game. You just paint the tape, you know, it's the kind of thing if you did in the stock market, you'd be in jail, but in the crypto market, it's not regulated. But none of what I just described, and there's a lot more to say on that, but none of that has anything to do with AI. So I would say it's not that you couldn't use AI to manipulate the market, but it's already being manipulated in good old-fashioned ways.
Gold has had a hell of a run. Do you think gold has just put in a short-term or long-term top?
No, it's somewhere near close to a top. It'll get to 10,000 a lot faster than people expect. I would expect it to go much higher than that, but 10,000, we're right at 4,000 today as we're speaking. 10,000 seems really far away. It's like, gee, it took a long time to get from 2,000 to 3,000. With four, all right, but it's going to take a really long time to get to 10. It won't. It's going to happen much faster than people think. And I really, really enjoyed this interview. It's been great talking to you.
Silver also had a hell of a run, finally to new all-time highs. Does it look like silver has just put in short-term or long-term tops?
No, silver will tag along with gold. It tags along with a lag, and silver is more difficult to analyze. But the issue is because silver is a precious metal, as is gold, but gold does not have very many industrial outputs, almost none. Silver does in catalytic converters, electronics, and a lot else. So with silver, you have to analyze it as a precious metal that pulls in one direction, but as industrial output, it could be pulling in the opposite direction if manufacturing is slowing down, which it is. So, but having said that, there's no way that gold is going to 10,000, but silver won't go to 200. It might lag a little bit, but it's along for the ride.
Palladium and platinum have had great moves. Is it looking like they have put in short-term or long-term tops?
Yeah, I don't know anything about palladium and platinum. I don't really cover them at all. And I do have to go, so it's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show. Jim, again, can you remind people where they can get your new book?
Thank you. The book is called Money GPT, AI and the Threat to the Global Economy. It's available on Amazon and at good bookstores. And my X account is at Real Jim Rickards. So hope people enjoy the book. And thank you. It's been great being with you.
Thank you. My guest has been Jim Rickards, founder of the James Rickards Projects and the author of many books. His latest book is Money GPT, AI and the Threat to the Global Economy. Coming up, Victor Adair, next on This Week in Money.